From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. The most recent fighting between the Israel Defense Forces and Hamas, now 2 weeks old, is, like all modern wars, partly a battle of images. Dead and wounded children in Gaza, military funerals, and fear in Israel. One image you haven't seen anywhere, however, is that of U.S. reporters on the ground in Gaza.
Close to 300 foreign nationals were allowed out of Gaza, but no journalists were allowed in. Israel continues to reject international calls for a return to free press.
I talked to the Vice Prime Minister about that today. I said, look, why aren't you allowing journalists to go into Gaza? And he said, why do you want to go in? And I said, look, we're journalists. This is what we do. We need to report on the situation.
They're actually surprisingly open about why they're not allowing journalists inside. They say they don't want too much information coming out of Gaza.
The Israeli military has barred foreign correspondents from entering the Gaza Strip, despite an Israeli Supreme Court ruling mandating at least limited access for journalists. Ethan Bronner is Jerusalem bureau chief for the New York Times. He says in order to understand the current crackdown on the press, you have to go back to the summer of 2006.
That's right. In 2006, in the war against Hezbollah in Lebanon, the Israeli and foreign media had sort of the run of the place. People were constantly talking to soldiers about their lack of good guns and decent food and enough water. There were mid-level commanders going live on radio talking about what they thought ought to happen. And the commission that was set up by the government at the end of that war to examine what had gone wrong devoted some attention to the media policy of the army and decided that it was not good at all for the strategic objectives of the army. So they revamped their information policy, and they've also taken away cell phones from soldiers, fearful that when they were talking in Lebanon at that time, that Hezbollah was listening.
Israel has a long celebrated tradition of a free and vigorous press. Have average Israelis weighed in on this policy or the Israeli media?
Kind of shockingly, no. So far in this war, and it may be beginning to change now, but fundamentally for the first week or 10 days for sure, there was a strong uniformity of view in Israel that this was a vital, justified war, and that those who didn't get that weren't really worth worrying about. So that when foreign journalists were complaining about not having access, people really were unimpressed. The fact that there's a war here is part of a general sense in Israel of existential threat that is hard for outsiders to grasp.
Ethan, is your coverage at the Times significantly different than it would have been without the ban? It would have to be, right?
Oh, it's enormously different. I mean, I want to say one thing, which is that we have in Gaza a full-time contract writer named Tagrid El-Khoderi, a brave, serious professional, and our on-the-ground stuff is coming from her. But she is not a native English speaker, and she is not a staff member of the New York Times. For us, if we could get in to Gaza, believe me, the coverage would be bigger, better, and stronger. We know that. Of course, it's a dangerous situation on the ground as well. There are places one would not be able to go instantly, but it would certainly be a much more comprehensive look, and not necessarily all to the ill of the Israel Defense Forces. I mean, we would certainly be looking at people who have allowed their children to be placed in front of fighters and that sort of thing. It would be the whole range of stories.
So what do you think, then? Is the ban working the way that the Israeli government hoped it would, or is it backfiring?
I really don't think it's working for them. I mean, for one thing, Al Jazeera is in Gaza, and the wires, AP, Reuters, AFP, all have cameras and Palestinian reporters on the ground, and they're all doing serious work, and we're all grateful to them. It is not doing what the Israelis would think, but I can't say that if we were to go in, they would be happier necessarily. I would say that their focus on controlling the message that way is a little bit of a false focus. And I also think, as I said, that a lot of the issue of keeping us out has to do with the defense ministry's decision that they don't want reporters in their way as they, quote-unquote, do their job.
One last question. How complete do you think the coverage is that the Israelis themselves are getting? I know you're saying that they've been, so far, quite unified over the war in Gaza, but do you think they're getting an unfiltered view of the carnage?
They're not, no. I mean, of course, they're watching the BBC and Sky and CNN just like anyone else, but usually enraged as they watch it, convinced that this is coverage aimed to harm them. If you look at the Israeli papers, of course, this is going to be true, I would imagine, in any country at war. You see an enormous focus on themselves and their own forces, and a kind of by-the-way focus on what may be happening to the people in Gaza. So I'm certain that they are not getting a full, unfiltered view of what's happening there. That's absolutely true.
Ethan, thank you very much.
Thank you, Brooke.
Ethan Bronner is Jerusalem Bureau Chief for The New York Times.
Few stories demand context as much as violence in the Middle East. For instance, it's undeniably true to say that the Gaza war was triggered by Hamas's rocket attacks into civilian areas in southern Israel. But it is equally true to say those rockets are in response to the crushing and often dehumanizing blockade Israel imposed on Gaza after Hamas seized power from the more moderate Fatah government. But it's also true that Hamas is dedicated to the destruction of Israel. But it's also true that Israel has been an occupier of Gaza for 40 years. But it's also true that the occupation resulted from three failed Arab wars against Israel. But it's also true that the State of Israel was imposed on native Palestinians by world powers, and so on and on and on. So how to cover the current crisis? Do you focus on Hamas's tactics of using schools, mosques, and other civilian areas to coordinate and launch attacks? Or do you focus on the deaths of civilians and the general devastation to Gazan society from the Israeli invasion? At Al Jazeera English, the answer is decidedly B. Here's a report from correspondent Ayman Mojahedin.
Since Israel's assault on Gaza began, the United Nations has converted dozens of schools into shelters, taking in the thousands trying to escape the war. But even these schools have not been spared Israel's war machine. On Tuesday, the Fakhoura school was the third makeshift UN shelter attacked.
The Palestinian point of view has long been a staple of Al Jazeera English's coverage, as with its larger Arabic language parent. But there is a wrinkle this time around. As one of the few news organizations inside of Gaza, Al Jazeera English's pictures and coverage are a major source of reporting and images for the entire world. It is, in effect, the pool reporter for everybody. Does this situation demand a different approach to reporting? Joining us now is the executive producer for news at Al Jazeera English, Paul McKinney. Paul, welcome to OTM.
Thank you very much, and thank you for having me here.
Let's begin with how we got there. How has it come to pass that Al Jazeera English has unique access to this story of war?
Well, we've been based in Gaza permanently since before we went on air. We launched just over 2 years ago. Our very first story on air in our very first program was from Gaza. Since then, we have reported consistently, almost daily, from Gaza. The humanitarian crisis has been a very big part of our reporting. But of course, we've also reported on the political developments, both looking in detail at Fatah and Hamas, and of course, bringing a wider context with our reporting from throughout the region.
Now, I assumed for the purposes of the introduction here that your slant has been fundamentally sympathetic to the Palestinian populace of Gaza. Do I have that wrong?
I wouldn't see it in that way at all. What we are doing is the absolute most basic form of reporting, which is telling the story that we see before us. Now, clearly in the past 2 weeks, the most important and compelling part of this story has been the effect on the civilian population in Gaza. But we have been rolling on this 24 hours a day for the past fortnight, and that means that we're able to give a much broader context, not just talking about the humanitarian crisis, but looking at the politics of this, reporting extensively from Israel, across the Middle East, and indeed from the United States, and looking at the role of the US and the international community.
Clearly, different outlets are framing the coverage in very different ways. For example, the Jerusalem Post, which is kind of a center-right paper from Israel, has done all of its coverage under the banner Confronting Hamas. Al Jazeera English is using the phrase war on Gaza. Now, that obviously looks at the question from a very different perspective.
We believe that that phrase provides an accurate reflection of what is happening at the moment because it is an offensive on Gaza.
Well, I'm sure you could get someone from the IDF to say that's absolutely not true. It is not a war on Gaza. It is a war on Hamas.
No, sure. And indeed, in our coverage, we have consistently, daily, almost hourly, ensured that that point of view from the Israeli army and Israel generally is given its voice. But we feel that as a summation of what is happening at the moment, that is an accurate and fair title.
From a journalistic point of view, this is a particularly thorny story to cover because violence is being meted out by Israel, and yet the culpability is not necessarily clear. Is Hamas responsible for not ceasing its rocket attacks? Is it responsible for firing from civilian areas? How do you frame that in your day-to-day coverage?
Well, we report the humanitarian crisis. We report what our correspondents are seeing on the ground. But the important thing is that we give wider context by reporting on what the military and political leaders are saying, but then attempting to cut through that spin, as it were, to put aside the propaganda. And because we are a 24-hour news channel that is concentrating so many resources on this story, I think we're able to do that in a way that is more comprehensive than certainly viewers in the United States will have seen.
I understand that entirely, although you would have to conclude at this stage that there is an ongoing catastrophe for the Gazans and a propaganda bonanza for Hamas, just because of the nature of the images that you're feeding, no?
Yeah, I'd of course we have got to be conscious of how either side are using the war for propaganda purposes. And that's why, as well as reporting the effects of shelling on either side, our job is to give detailed, extensive interviews and analyse what both sides are doing, because there's a propaganda war on both sides.
Paul, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Paul McKinney is executive producer for news at Al Jazeera English.
Quick, name the Surgeon General of the United States. Actually, the position has been vacant since Richard Carmona left in 2006, but you probably never heard of him anyway. You probably have heard of the man tapped by Barack Obama to replace him, CNN's Doctor-in-Chief Sanjay Gupta.
So, you've been splurging the last few weeks, or you just want to get fit in 2009. Well, we've got some surefire strategies to help drop the pounds.
Saying, look, I know this person's depression is better. You know how I know? Because their frontal lobes are lighting up. This is a brave new world of neuroscience, actually being able to
assign. Okay, let's say you're out in the middle of the jungle in Cameroon, as I am right now. And let's say you get really thirsty. Cut down a vine with a machete. You have to have a machete.
Gupta hosts a weekend show, writes a column for Time magazine, authored a national bestseller, and has been named one of People magazine's sexiest men alive. Also, he's a neurosurgeon at a downtown Atlanta hospital. So what's it mean when a media star becomes our nation's family doctor? Dr. Fitzhugh Mullen is professor of medicine and health policy at George Washington University and a former assistant surgeon general under C. Everett Koop. He says surgeons general have had their share of controversy. Take FDR's SG, Tom Perrin.
Tom Perrin, in the 1930s, was concerned about venereal disease. He went on national radio, I believe it was CBS, and talked candidly about syphilis. CBS said that he could not do that, and they would have to take that part of the interview out because he didn't talk about venereal disease on the radio. And he said, you take that out, you take the whole interview out, I won't be interviewed if I can't talk straight. They left the interview in, and in fact, the publicity about the effort to muzzle the discussion of venereal disease generated more controversy, more discussion, and actually more candor.
And he had the support of FDR?
He was supported. That was early in his tenure. He served for another 10 or so years. In more recent years, Jocelyn Elders, who served under President Clinton, first spoke out about needle exchange, which she favored. She was admonished for that. And subsequently, she spoke about masturbation, which was just generally considered a taboo topic, and she was dismissed effectively following that.
The most recent Surgeon General, Richard Carmona, he was blocked from talking about stem cell research and emergency contraception and was apparently instructed to reference the president several times on every page of his speeches. Is Carmona kind of an object lesson of how this job can go wrong?
Dr. Carmona's tenure represents one extreme of how the president has handled the Surgeon Generalship, and that's been essentially house arrest. He was blocked in being efficient or being useful in a lot of areas in which he thought, as a public health leader, he should be articulate. And the one that really, I think, rankled was that he finally spoke out on passive smoke, and the tobacco industry didn't like that, and that had to do with his being dismissed at the end of his term.
So is the Surgeon General fundamentally the nation's doctor or the nation's health communicator?
Certainly the tradition of communication, of articulating issues, is very important. What I think is different about the Gupta regime in the public health service is he's also an accomplished practitioner of health policy. He's worked in the White House before. He's been outspoken on policy issues. And indeed, he also has a secondary appointment in the White House Health Reform Office. The Surgeon General has not always been the principal spokesman on health policy issues. That's a new role, and it'll be interesting to see how that plays itself out.
You know, when we went through the list of notable past Surgeon General controversies, we stopped short of probably the most famous Surgeon General of all, the one you worked with, C. Everett Koop.
Dr. Koop came to office in the early days of the AIDS epidemic, and he was an appointee of an administration, the Reagan administration, that over those first years of the AIDS epidemic in the early 80s showed no inclination to talk about it or do much about it. And Koop, pretty much on his own, raised those issues to public attention in terms of how we dealt with the epidemic as a whole and individuals with HIV in general. And really, he set a very high bar for Surgeons General, stepping out from their administration and taking an important, often controversial, public health stand. President Reagan tolerated him, certainly stayed till the end of his administration, but it was an anomalous or unusual situation.
And you've suggested that great Surgeon Generals, like great presidents, are tested in times of national emergency. Do you see anything like that in the offing for Sanjay Gupta?
Well, we are in a national emergency, not only in an economic sense and a military sense, but in terms of health care. Obesity, in particular pediatric obesity, are huge and as yet not fully appreciated epidemics in this country. But health equity, that is, how do we give all of our citizens a similar shot at the benefits of modern medical science, is also a cause that could very much be that of the Surgeon General. I suspect that the legacy of Dr. Gupta will be the citizen forces and industry forces that he can rally to take on these health issues in American society.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Brooke.
Fitzhugh Mullen is Murdoch Head Professor of Medicine and Health Policy at George Washington University and a former Assistant Surgeon General.
When the war began a few years back over the format for high-definition DVDs, it felt like a reenactment of the historic battle between VHS and Betamax. This time it was Blu-ray versus HD DVD. And last year at the annual International Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas, Blu-ray was declared the winner. Yet despite strong sales of the Dark Knight disc and Blu-ray players, there's a chorus of naysayers. Many tech watchers see Blu-ray facing a threat from movies that stream directly over the internet to your TV, rendering the Blu-ray disc unnecessary. Last year, we talked to Shane Bettner at the Consumer Electronics Show. He's a writer and editor for Home Theater Magazine, and he joins us once again to explain what's happened since Blu-ray's victory lap last year.
I think what has really happened is that people are expecting a little too much too quickly with respect to Blu-ray, and they see these other ways of consuming media, whether it be streaming or downloads, as encroaching on that territory.
Okay, so prices are down. That's good. And the number of titles available via Blu-ray is going up. That's good. But the internet delivery is making a bit of a charge. Is that categorically going to be the future of watching high-def movies at home?
Personally, I think that the jury is very much out on that. I think that what a lot of people are doing is they're making assumptions about Blu-ray's future based on what they saw happen in the music download industry. It's unequivocal at this point. Downloaded MP3s won that particular format war. Convenience absolutely trumped quality in the minds of most consumers. I think the thing that people really need to keep in mind is that movies, they're much different than music. Music downloads are very fast, very cheap, very convenient. When you're talking about downloading 112 kilobit per second MP3 song, that takes just a few seconds on a decent broadband connection. That's a much different thing than either streaming or certainly even downloading a movie experience.
So in 2009, how does one stream or download a film? What is the mechanism and who are the sources for doing this?
I would say right now that Netflix is really leading the charge in a major way. They are making a number of strong deals. LG and Samsung both have Blu-ray players that enable Netflix streaming. The Xbox 360 enables Netflix streaming, so they're definitely in something of a commanding position in that space right now. But you really need a fast broadband connection to get something even approaching DVD quality, let alone high definition.
And that's the limiting factor, is it not? Unless more Americans have access to very high-speed broadband, streaming or downloaded movies overtaking physical media like Blu-ray, it's just impossible for the time being.
I should probably just state up front, I don't really share the gloom and doom view of Blu-ray's future that I'm reading from some pundits in the industry. I think people, you know, they not only want success now, they want it to be dramatic and overwhelming, and they want it to happen overnight. The other day, I was reading through some industry news, and there was a statistic there that I found that was very interesting. It mentioned the fact that rental revenue and home video, DVD did not surpass the VHS tape until 2003. I think that puts it at about 6 years after DVD's introduction before it took over the rental market, for example. I think people are expecting a little bit too much too soon in the shape of Blu-ray. And I think that all the sales indicators and everything else, you know, a big title like The Dark Knight sell over 1 million copies in 1 week in the U.S. alone. I think we're seeing indicators that people are buying Blu-ray and they're getting it. I would like some of the people who think that downloads are about to take over the world for the in the movie world, or streaming, for example, I'd like to see somebody do a poll of the average guy in the street and see how many of those guys can tell you the difference between Hulu and Vudu.
So what you're suggesting is that while Blu-ray is probably an interim technology, that interim could last a long time and I guess generate many billions of dollars, no?
Yeah, I absolutely believe that. I think the thing that I would look at, again, is iTunes has figured out as much of the downloading and streaming side of the business as anybody has. You know, you don't see them standing up on the rooftops and beating their chest about the numbers they've done on movie downloads, and that's because the numbers simply aren't there.
Well, Shane, thank you very much.
Sure. I appreciate it.
Shane Bentner is editor of Home Theater Magazine.
Once, not so long ago, your computer was a box that you loaded with stuff. Say you wanted to use your PC to prepare your taxes. You had to buy and install costly and complicated tax preparation software. Away from home during tax season? Tough break. Computer crash? Wipe out your old filings? Again, tough break. Same thing at work. Each company paid for its own expensive, self-contained network infrastructure. But those days are quietly passing. Now our computers aren't boxes, they're doors we walk through to take care of business remotely. Increasingly, we do our taxes with software we didn't buy remotely. We do our banking remotely, store our photographs and music remotely. Many of us use Hotmail and Gmail, both operated remotely. It's called cloud computing, and it marks a paradigm shift. Nicholas Carr is the author of The Big Switch, Rewiring the World from Edison to Google, and he likens it to that moment when Americans abandoned their individual steam or wind power generators and hooked themselves up to the nation's electrical grid. For his book, Carr created a composite character named Jeff, whose creativity took flight when he soared up into that cloud.
Jeff is a guy who once, a few years ago, tried to put together a website. He's a fan of Mustang cars, and it was very expensive and time-consuming. He had to buy the software and the equipment, and he gave it up. It was just too hard to do. With cloud computing now, Jeff can go to a blog site running on somebody else's computer, set up a blog very easily. He can then go to other sites that will feed photographs or music into his blog site. He can go to Google and set up an ad account and run ads on his site. And in just a few minutes and for no cost whatsoever, he can develop this rich media outlet online that was impossible to do before you had all these cloud computing services to meld into whatever shape or form you wanted to meld them into.
Let's talk about the drawbacks of cloud computing for the average consumer. I mean, if I've got my communication and my banking on somebody else's server out there in the clouds, privacy has to be a huge concern. Aren't you worried about having so much personal information out in the ether?
Sure, I'm concerned. Not only just about the data we store about our bank accounts and so forth. You know, if you look at the search terms that somebody looks for on Google over time, you basically get an incredibly clear picture of who that person is because, you know, we search for our whole lives basically online, and all of that information is being stored in central databases. On the other hand, I think we all talk about being concerned about privacy, but really when you look at our behavior online, we don't seem to care much really because we continue to put all this information up on the net. And the reason we do it is because in return we get better search results, you get better content geared towards your particular needs, you get more personalized advertising. The bad side is you are disclosing incredibly personal information about yourself, and you're trusting that that information will never be abused. You know, my fear is that we might, in the end, find that that trust is misplaced.
On that subject, who's 441-7749?
That is Thelma Arnold, who had an America Online account. And at some point in the last couple of years, America Online decided, for very good reasons, to release to the academic community the search logs of people who used its service. And what it did was it stripped their names out and just replaced them with a number. It did it so researchers could better understand how people search and maybe make better search engines. And so what happened was after AOL released a batch of these search logs, a couple of reporters from the New York Times took one of the numbers and looked at all the terms, most of which were very innocuous. I think she was, you know, in her 60s, a widow named Thelma Arnold living in Georgia. And the next day, there's her picture on the front cover of the New York Times, and they interviewed her, and she said, here's my entire life laid out in a series of search terms.
And although Thelma Arnold was shocked, at least she wasn't embarrassed. As you write in your book, subscriber 59920 searched for what a neck looked like after it had been strangled and roped to use to hogtie someone. That guy, I'm assuming it's a guy, may have some serious cause for concern if a name is ever attached to it. What's the logical next step if users seem willing to surrender so much information for the sake of convenience? If a private company comes to know me, perhaps better than I know myself.
My worry is that we'll never know when we're being manipulated, when are companies so adept at analyzing information about us that they can begin to give us stimuli and information that they know will produce a certain kind of behavior, an instinct to buy something or to look in one particular way.
You know, we were talking in the office about Blu-ray, the new DVD format, and how some people are already predicting a very short life for it because of the ease and increasing quality of downloaded movies. No more DVD boxes in the house, no more CDs because of music we get from the web, no more books once they're all downloadable and deliverable onto your Kindle. Have you thought about the impact to culture and maybe to our own psyches of no longer surrounding ourselves with the stuff that we love, but just storing it in the cloud?
Yeah, that's an area I'm researching now, because I think, you know, more and more that's where we go to find everything we want to use. My fear is that we're substituting kind of the literary mind, which was a mind that was patient, could concentrate on a single line of reading for an extended period of time. We're replacing that mind with kind of the mind that the internet is encouraging in us, which is a mind that wants to seek out as much information as quickly as possible. And it strikes me that the price we might have to pay for this enormous convenience and to have all this information at our fingertips is the loss of our ability to concentrate or be contemplative, those things that require really sustained concentration. There's no reward for that kind of behavior on the internet. And my guess is we're going to see a fairly profound shift in how we define intellect and how we define culture as we move to getting everything, more or less, through this one medium of the internet.
Nicholas, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.
Nicholas Carr is the author of The Big Switch, Rewiring the World from Edison to Google, just out in paperback.
Coming up, we consider really, really old media.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for On the Media comes from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And the Wallace Foundation, where arts and education leaders can learn about how to bring the arts to more people. Downloads at the Knowledge Center at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. As we mentioned, this week, thousands of gadget makers and gadget lovers journey to the great city of Las Vegas for the annual Consumer Electronics Show. Each year, some products at the CES change consumer electronics history. Others don't. Take the 2001 flop, the iSmell, a product that once connected to your computer released a scent based on the website you were browsing. That one, as the New York Times reported this week, never made it past the prototype. So we wondered, what's this year's iSmell? Marguerite Reardon, a senior writer at CNET, is at the CES. She describes one likely contender.
I'm not so sold on the LG watch phone. I kind of think that watches went out, you know, like in 1995.
That's a watch that's also a phone, like a Dick Tracy wrist radio.
Exactly.
Max Smart talked into his shoe, but that was 1966 technology. Why do you think that a watch phone won't take off?
Well, I just think people have grown accustomed to not wearing watches, and we want our phones to do so much more now. You know, you can just pull out your cell phone, take a look at the time, but it also gets your email. It, you know, you can watch videos on it, gets your music. And I think the LG phone does have an MP3 player on it, but it's a tiny screen, and I just don't see it becoming hugely popular when the trend we're actually seeing is that people are really interested in smartphones, like the iPhone or the BlackBerry.
The cost of this item?
It's not available yet. They're saying, you know, later this year, this phone literally just came off the plane from Korea.
Any other non-starters? Anything else DOA?
You know, I'm still not completely sold on 3D TV. Panasonic is showing off some technology there. And, you know, you got to wear the glasses, and I'm not sure how many people want to sit around their living rooms with special glasses to watch a 3D football game or something. But the experience is pretty cool, so who knows? I mean, that's something that potentially could take off.
All right, so if CES is the high holidays of the gizmo universe, what's the mood in this economically depressed 2009?
People are cautious. Steve Ballmer, Microsoft CEO, last night during his keynote, I mean, that was the first thing he brought up was the economy. And he was basically just trying to be the cheerleader, like, but it's not going to be that bad. There's still hope. There's still innovation. I think all the consumer electronics makers are just crossing their fingers that people still need to buy a new TV.
Okay, Maggie. Well, listen, thank you very much. Enjoy the rest of the show.
Well, thanks for having me.
Marguerite Reardon is a senior writer for CNET. She spoke to us from this year's Consumer Electronics Show.
This week, the New York Times attempted to address its sharply declining revenue by introducing an occasional but prominent ad at the bottom of page one. To the purist, it's an intrusion, a violation of the choicest part of the gray lady's anatomy. To the realist, it's merely a reflection that in these troubled times you sell what you got. And online speculation says an ad on the Sunday front page can go for $100,000. But this is hardly the first change to page one. When the Times began on September 18, 1851, it was called the New York Daily Times. There were no pictures or jumps, and the page was cluttered and crammed. But it's had countless facelifts over the years, clearly charted in the book, The New York Times, The Complete Front Pages. Times reporter James Barron contributed to the book, and he says one big change was the introduction of bylines, unheard of in the paper's first century. He says that after World War II, the paper promoted its star reporters on page one.
Did it make people try to do better writing? I think probably it did. The paper reads better now than it did before. There's a lot of stuff you have to wade through in some of those early papers. The words, not necessarily the story.
They are written so turgidly and with complete transcripts rather than summaries attached, so no context seemed to be provided within the individual stories, just a bunch of stuff.
I'm trying not to say that because 100 years from now, somebody will be sitting where you're sitting and they'll be looking at stories I wrote and saying the same thing. That's why I let you say that.
One thing I noticed on those early front pages are not only are the stories very, very long, but sometimes the headlines are, too. There's one about Teddy Roosevelt being shot, where you don't even need the story. The entire story is in the headline.
Well, and it has a point of view. October 15th, 1912, two-line headline all across the front page, and here's what it says. It says, "Maniac in Milwaukee shoots Colonel Roosevelt. He ignores wound, speaks an hour, goes to hospital." Well, you're right, that pretty much does it. And a little bit of editorial comment about the stability of the gunman.
The only thing that I learned from the story that, I'm sorry they didn't get to squeeze in the headline, was that the bullet was stopped by the text of Teddy Roosevelt's speech.
I do, yes. And a fine stem winder it was. It took an hour to deliver.
You really see the first draft of history. Can you point me to one or two front pages that would have been written differently with the benefit of hindsight?
Well, if we were doing the Gettysburg Address now, we would have led with what Lincoln said there. We led the paper that day with a story about the war. The headline was, "Important from East Tennessee." Under that was a subhead that said, "The Rebels Advancing Upon Knoxville." And then you got a story headlined, "The Heroes of July." This was the story about what happened at Gettysburg, and the lead on that story began like this. "The ceremonies attending the dedication of the National Cemetery commenced this morning by a grand military and civic display under command of Major General Couch." What Lincoln said was very short, and we printed it in its entirety midway down the front page, because Lincoln was basically an afterthought. The idea of what history remembers from that, this very short, eloquent, touching speech by Lincoln, the reporter on the scene didn't apparently see quite the significance of it, or under the conventions of the day, didn't shape the article around that.
You've also noted that when you look back at headlines, you really get to see the context for historic events. I think you noted March 21st, 1933. On the right side of the paper, you see an article explaining how Franklin Delano Roosevelt will get extraordinary new executive powers to address the economy.
That's right.
And then on the left side of the front page, what do you find?
Reichstag meeting today is prepared to give Hitler full control as dictator. It would have been fascinating to have been able to sit in on the page one meeting that day and see how they decided.
Sometimes you can foresee the significance of events, and sometimes you can't. But I think there were omissions that perhaps the paper needed to answer for. For instance, there was nothing on page one, at least while it was going on, about the Holocaust.
I know, and that's troubling. And I can't go back and ask the editors who were there then, what did you know and why, if you knew about it, why you didn't put this on the front page. It's just very troubling to me.
I think maybe we can learn something about the conventions of journalism by comparing two similar events, both covered by the Times, Lincoln's assassination and Kennedy's assassination. When Lincoln was assassinated, the word that was used on the front page was awful, awful news.
Yeah.
And the Kennedy assassination?
Was told much more factually, if you want to put it that way. Let me read that headline. It said, Kennedy is killed by sniper as he rides in car in Dallas. Johnson sworn in on plane. Well, the editorializing had gone over to the editorial page. The opinion about the event, the describing the event in the way awful news makes it sound, that was left for the editorial page. Tom Wicker, who wrote the story that day, it's an inverted pyramid story. President John Fitzgerald Kennedy was shot and killed by an assassin today, period. That's the lead.
There was a Pew study recently, and it found that for the first time, more people are getting their news online, something like 45% compared to newspapers, which is apparently 35%. I'm surprised it's that high. If people are getting their news from, say, the New York Times website, they don't get the full benefit, I guess, of the editor's notion of what ought to be front page news because they aren't seeing the front page. They're seeing something else.
Well, they get a different sense of it. Newspapers, if you think about it, are about setting priorities. That's what editors do by organizing the front page. That's a snapshot of a day. If you go to the homepage of nytimes.com, it's a snapshot of a much shorter period, but it's still determined by editors who go to the same meetings during the day as the editors who determine what goes on the front page of the print version. So what you get at the top of the homepage may be two or three stories. At 2 minutes of 3 o'clock or something, that's what's important at that point. It's a smaller window.
I see what you're saying, that there still is, you know, very strict editorial supervision of what goes on the homepage. But I have to say, as a reader, I read it differently. I don't pay as much attention to those stories that are being featured. I tend to go down to the sections that I want to more quickly, and I don't get to have the accidental encounter with those other stories that I might see if I were turning physical pages. So my experience of the paper is very different online, and the importance of those editorial decisions about what comes first is much diminished.
And I think that's one of the things that journalism is going to have to grapple with if the shift continues that the Pew study found.
You know, this week the New York Times joined other major U.S. papers by introducing a small ad at the bottom of the front page. Now, isn't this sacred real estate? What does this say about the state of the newspaper, or at least about the state of the front page of the newspaper?
What it says is a lot of other newspapers have tried that, and it's worked for them. They've found advertisers who want to be in that space because the front page gets attention for them.
Of course.
The same way it gets attention for stories.
Of course. No advertiser would turn down the front page. They just never had the opportunity to get on it before.
Well, no. Now, the Times did have short little ads, two or three lines of tiny type at the bottom of the front page until a few years ago. People would buy them to propose or to say happy birthday to somebody. For a while, I think there was a cable company that bought them.
Tiny, tiny three lines, just those little lost pieces at the bottoms of the columns.
And
hardly visible.
And this was different, but times are different now. Our readership has migrated to the web. These are hard times for newspapers. I can't think of any softer way to put it. And plenty harder that I can think of.
You know, do you think that this is some Rubicon that shouldn't have been crossed? Or as a employee of the Times, would you rather not be asked that question?
I'll take the fifth on this one, please.
James, thank you very much.
Thank you.
James Barron is a reporter at the New York Times and a contributor to the book, The New York Times, The Complete Front Pages, 1851 to 2008.
At Washington's Folger Shakespeare Library through the end of this month is an exhibition titled Renaissance Journalism and the Birth of the Newspaper. tracing the news industry from the late 16th century. It's a fascinating evolution filled with such artifacts as early handwritten newsletters, one-sheet foreign-published corantos, bound news books, and printed weekly newspapers in continuous circulation to this day. The exhibit is a voyage into antiquity, conducted for me by the Folger's Betsy Walsh, here pointing to a slim Elizabethan-era volume reporting on a scandal in Rome.
This particular one is an account of an attempt on the life of the Pope. However, there is an illustration of the man who is confronting the Pope with a gun, but there's a little bubble, what we would consider a cartoon, so that the reader is invited to put his own caption.
Interactive.
Yes, the early interactive.
An odd little foreshadowing of things three centuries later to come. But that's where the similarities end, because everything about Elizabethan journalism is as dated as a ruffed collar, a codpiece, and a barrel of mead. It's just astonishing what in those quaint and primitive days of yore passed for news.
We have a report here from 1669 of the eruption of Mount Etna, which includes an engraved picture of the event that was brought back by a traveler.
3 days after the eruption of Mount St. Helens in southwest Washington state, imponderables dust the air like volcanic ash.
This is strange news of a prodigious monster, which seems to what we would call conjoined twins that were born in London. And so this is an account of that sort of unnatural birth.
Salt Lake City, where doctors are performing a separation surgery on some four-year-old conjoined twin girls. And can you imagine?
Shortly before Christmas in 1679, Mr. Dryden, the King's Poet Laureate, was coming out of a coffee house on Thursday night and was set upon by three men who did beat him so severely that 'tis thought he will hardly recover.
A black BMW cruises slowly down the Las Vegas Strip. Inside, rap and film star Tupac Shakur sits in the passenger seat. No one sees the white Cadillac that slowly pulls up alongside, or the gun that's aimed directly at Tupac.
The archaic flavor of early journalism wasn't limited to pulp nonfiction either. It was thick with tales of the devil's work and imagined conspiracies of the sort that would never be worthy of mention in modern times. Betsy Walsh.
Well, this particular one is an update on a very hot topic at the time, the Popish plot, supposed plot. It was more of a conspiracy theory that the Catholics were trying to overthrow Charles II, who was a Protestant, and replace him with his Catholic brother, James.
The Popish plot allegation, Walsh says, triggered an investigation by Magistrate
Sir Edmund Barry Godfrey, who found that the accusations were probably without merit. Unfortunately, before the decision was totally rendered, the magistrate was found dead. His body was found in a London park.
Deputy White House Counsel Vincent Foster Jr. was found dead at 6 p.m. in Fort Marcy Park, just outside.
Unlike today, most news in Renaissance England was from abroad, less owing to English curiosity about foreign events than to royal suppression of domestic news, which was considered by both Parliament and throne as inherently destabilizing or even seditious. How silly and retro.
It was a shameful act for someone to disclose this very important program in time of war.
Well into the 18th century, the only domestic news permitted was that disseminated through licensees of the state.
They wouldn't allow printers to print news of the government because they thought the people should not be allowed to interpret government activities for themselves. But they realized that there would be some advantage to using the press to get their message out to the people.
One network has fair and balanced coverage. Stay with Fox News Channel.
As early as 1650, the mini mass media were subsidized by advertising, mainly for sleazy patent medicines such as Digby's Sympathetical Powder. Snake oil claims, of course, long since obliterated by vigilant government regulators.
Extends is a simple tablet that can make virtually any man larger, noticeably larger. We're so sure Extends will make you larger, we're going to send you a week's supply absolutely free.
I'm pleased to report that the foibles and excesses of early journalism did not go unnoticed in their time. In the early 1600s, Shakespeare contemporary Ben Jonson wrote a play titled The Staple of News, ridiculing both the purveyors and consumers of gossip, scandal, and propaganda. How blessed we are that no such satire is necessary today.
Yesterday, the New York Times made an announcement. They're reducing the width of their newspaper by an inch and a half. We did it. That's an inch and a half less of state secrets revealed every day.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Jamie York, Mike Volo, Mark Phillips, and Nazanin Rafsanjani, and edited by Brooke. We had technical direction from Jennifer Munson and more engineering help from Zach Marsh. We also had help from Dina Prechep. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.